District Sentinel Radio here. Time for your nightly newscast from the left. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're broadcasting out of the Harper is a Good Girl studios in Washington, D.C. Check out the website, districtsentinel.com. We just wrapped up an interview here in the studio with Brace Belden, a.k.a. Piss Pig Granddad.
A.k.a. Piss Pig Grandma.
A.k.a. the American who joined up with YPG in Syria to fight ISIS. A.k.a. the guy who's going to be played by Jake Gyllenhaal in a movie.
Maybe, hopefully not. We mostly talked about what it was like coming back. I know Brace has done a few interviews already with some podcasts you're probably familiar with. So we basically centered our discussion on what it was like coming back and re-entering the United States because, you know, that was a little knees weak, palms sweaty, arms are heavy moment.
Yeah.
If you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. And
vomit on a sweater already.
Yeah, we were also
mom spaghetti.
Yeah, we were also less interested in the whole ISIS fighting and more interested in how to break back into the floral game.
Yeah. He's back in the floral game. So, San Francisco people, if you need some flowers, and no, that's not slang for drugs because flowers is slang for weed.
Oh. No, we're talking about actual flowers.
Yeah, we're talking about actual flowers.
Brace's interview is going to come out Friday for the Sentinel cast, available for subscribers only on Patreon, which reminds me there were a lot of bad takes today following the Georgia special election. So if you are a subscriber already, head over to our Patreon and put in your garbage can nominations for the week. Voting begins Thursday night.
I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest, if I end up on the list because I previously said on this show that I didn't think there would be really any lessons to be learned from a single special election in the Atlanta suburbs. Well, I think I was proven wrong in a fact pointed out by Steve Kornacki, one of the only smart MSNBC people. Last night, Kornacki tweeted numbers from recent special elections, noting that in Kansas, Dems improved on the Trump-Clinton victory margin by 20 points. In Montana, they improved by 15 points, same as in South Carolina, in their special election also last night. John Ossoff, though, he lost by 5.5 points last night.
Didn't all those other candidates you mentioned run on single payer?
I know that for sure in Kansas and Montana they did.
Okay, at least two of them did.
I know the candidate in South Carolina, he was a bit of a technocrat, but he did speak to more bread and butter issues, whereas Ossoff was like, well, I'll fix the debt.
We need to become like a tech company here in Atlanta.
God. Yes, so as I was about to say, that guy lost by 5.5 points last night, whereas in the same district last year, Trump barely beat Clinton. In other words, the centrist golden boy who wants to turn everything into Silicon Valley seems to have underperformed. And by the way, if you're running for a congressional seat, I don't know how like wanting to turn your congressional district into Silicon Valley makes sense. If you want to do that, you should run for local office.
Yeah.
It was just extremely dumb.
And already Democrats are not learning the right lessons from this. I assume they're going to probably want to throw Ossoff back in there when this race is rerun again next year. Ossoff last night said this is the beginning of a movement. Movement for failure is what it will be. Anyways, let's get on with the rest of the news of the day. It's Wednesday, June 21st, 2017. Here's what's going on. The former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson testified before the House Intelligence Committee on Tuesday. It was the latest public hearing in the committee's probe of alleged Russian interference in last year's election. And notable about Johnson's testimony was the revelation that the Department of Homeland Security, like the FBI, was denied access to the DNC's hacked servers last year. Here was Johnson talking about the post-hack interactions between the DNC and his department.
This was fresh off the OPM experience, and there was a point at which DHS cybersecurity experts did get into OPM and actually help them discover the bad actors and patch some of the exfiltrations, or at least minimize some of the damage. And so I was anxious to know whether or not our folks were in there. And the response I got was FBI had spoken to them. They don't want our help. They have CrowdStrike, the cybersecurity firm. And that was the answer I got after I asked the question a number of times over the progression of time. And I recall very clearly that I was not pleased that we were not in there helping them patch this vulnerability.
Johnson, of course, at the beginning, they're referring to the Office of Personnel Management hack in 2015, allegedly done by the Chinese government that resulted in like 21 million people's private information being exfiltrated. And Johnson talking about how he didn't get permission to do the same sort of forensic analysis at the DNC servers.
Once again, the DNC preferring private contractors over public sector workers.
Yeah. Republicans, as you'd expect, seized on the lack of access DHS and FBI had to the DNC servers. Here's Congressman Trey Gowdy treading on a conspiracy line here, which Jay Johnson didn't bother to shoot down.
If they had turned the server over to either you or Director Comey, maybe we would have known more, and maybe there would have been more for you to report. So I guess what I'm asking you is, why would the victim of a crime not turn over a server to the intelligence community or to law enforcement?
I'm not going to argue with you, sir. That was a leading question, and I'll agree to be led.
Now, the intelligence community relied on its own intel, as well as the forensics produced by CrowdStrike, to publicly blame Russia for the hacking last October. Since then, however, a separate report from CrowdStrike has been called into question. Last year, CrowdStrike alleged that the Kremlin hacked Ukrainian artillery units, leading to their destruction. The company used that report to buttress their claims about the DNC. But after the head of Ukrainian defense came forward and said there was no hack and no lost artillery, CrowdStrike had to walk back portions of their report. Johnson said, though, on Wednesday that he was confident the Russians were behind the hacks. He said the events of last summer inspired him in January to make election systems a part of critical infrastructure, affording them more cybersecurity protections. Johnson admitted it was something he probably should have done earlier.
And I was watching the Senate Intelligence Committee that was doing a similar hearing with cybersecurity officials, including a DHS official. And really, the only takeaway from there is that there were claims that Russia was hacking, not necessarily
probing,
exactly, probing 21 states' election systems.
I think a week ago, Bloomberg reported it was 39. This official said it was 21. Johnson was asked about it, too. He said he didn't know the exact number, but yeah.
They also noted, again, though, that there were, there was no evidence of changing of vote totals, which would obviously be a little troubling, to say the least, if they said anything else.
And one last thing to add, that official who spoke at the Senate Intel Committee said that electronic voting machines can be hacked, which caused a lot of people in like the Clinton camp, I noticed Joy Reid specifically, raise their eyes at that, like, oh, look at this bit of information. And it's like, we've had people for years testifying to Congress that election machines can be hacked. You had Bernie Sanders supporters throughout the primary, and I'm not going to say that systems were hacked and that's why he lost. But whenever you had these people talk about the vulnerabilities of election machines, they were dismissed as conspiracy theorist idiots. Well, who's the conspiracy theorist now?
Somehow Trump's vision of draining the swamp doesn't include shadowy courts that can only be accessed by corporations through free trade deals. That was the message sent to the American people today by Robert Lighthizer, the current U.S. trade representative. Lighthizer was asked about so-called investor-state dispute settlement panels at a Senate Finance Committee hearing by Ohio Democrat Sherrod Brown. Brown specifically wanted to know if the imminent renegotiation of NAFTA will include the scrapping of ISDS. Here was Lighthizer's meandering reply.
First of all, there is a negotiating objective, as I understand it, that we're going to strengthen ISDS. But having said that, I really look forward to working with the committee on that issue. It's an issue that is troubling to me. It's troubling me on a variety of issues, and it's on a variety of levels. It's a balancing act. Clearly, our investors have a right to have their property protected. On the other hand, There are, in my judgment, at least sovereignty issues. I'm always troubled by the fact that non-elected, non-Americans can make a decision that a United States law is invalid. Just as a matter of principle, I find that offensive.
He finds it troubling and offensive. But as he said in his response, investors need their protection racket. Lighthizer confirmed this shortly after. There are no plans to actually get rid of these corporate kangaroo courts in NAFTA renegotiation.
I would not commit that we're going to get rid of ISDS. I would certainly commit that I want to engage with this committee and with the Ways and Means Committee and others in Congress to see what we can do to perhaps rebalance where we are in this situation where we have two interests, both of which are valid.
If concerns about investor protections are valid, you'd think they would just, I don't know, use regular courts like the rest of us. But no, that's not the case. Corporate interests think they deserve special courts where only they can bring lawsuits. And the Trump administration sees no problem with this shit.
Yeah, their courts are tight. They bring the lawsuits. They are the lawyers in the proceedings, and they're the judges as well.
Yeah. The arbitration panel is staffed with basically
corporate lawyers.
Yeah, exactly. So, by the way, here are three examples of cases adjudicated by NAFTA ISDS. Shout out to Public Citizen, Naked Capitalism, and Corrente for pointing these out. I'll just go through, three, like I said. Number one, a Canadian funeral home company sued the United States for $725 million for being forced to post bond when appealing a $500 million jury award for anti-competitive practices. This was basically an attack on the entire U.S. judicial system, the jury award, the bond posting for the appeal, et cetera, et cetera. Number two, a U.S. waste treatment company got a $6 million award from the Canadian government for temporarily banning polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, which the EPA has declared dangerous. And finally, number three, another U.S. waste management company called Metalclad got $16 million from Mexico after a Mexican city government had ordered the company to tidy up a mess at a toxic waste facility before expanding it. So yeah, baby, drain that swamp.
Yeah, there's a bit of a misconception that the U.S., that ISDS are bad because the U.S. is constantly getting its shit handed to them, when really it's the U.S. like owning other countries in these lawsuits all the time.
Right, but it still forces it's still a driver of the race to the bottom.
Yeah, exactly.
So it everyone loses except for these narrow
corporations.
Exactly. So anyway, the guy who says he wants to make free trade into fair trade, he's cool with this shit. He's seeking to preserve this shadowy court system.
We knew Wall Street would be writing its own regulations now that Trump was in charge, but we didn't think it would be so literally true. A report from Americans for Financial Reform reveals that the Trump Treasury Department basically plagiarized its entire agenda from a Wall Street interest group. I'm going to read from that report here. It says, quote, in its rush to eviscerate the Dodd-Frank reforms, Treasury Department adopted over three quarters of the ideas put forward by the Clearinghouse, an association of the biggest U.S. and international banks. Americans for Financial Reform found that Treasury called for deregulation in 17 of the 20 areas of banking oversight, which the Clearinghouse advocated for. And the department also proposed action on 31 out of 40 specific requests by the big banks. Marcus Stanley, the policy director at Americans for Financial Reform, said in a statement, quote, copying someone else's work isn't appropriate for a student, and it isn't any more acceptable when the federal government simply copies Wall Street suggestions for how to dismantle protections against the next financial crisis. So they're just as lazy over at Treasury as they are corrupt. Got it. Okay.
Steve Mnuchin's okay. I gotta say, he's been doing it less when I've seen him speak. He's obviously been working on it.
Or he's a bit self-conscious about it.
Well, both.
Yeah,
it can be both, yeah. Trump maybe yelled at him a few times to stop doing it. I wouldn't be surprised. Here's a bit of good news for now, although this could be like when they let a rescue dog find a live body so it doesn't get depressed. But fuck it, I'll bite. Wisconsin Republican Ron Johnson is throwing cold water on Mitch McConnell's plan to hold a vote on health care next week. Johnson told CNN, quote, I'm going to need time and my constituents are going to need time to evaluate exactly how this is going to affect them. So I personally think that holding a vote on this next week would definitely be rush, end of quote. McConnell can only afford 3 defections or the bill dies in the Senate. And whether or not Ron Johnson ends up voting for the legislation, a delay will give activists significant time to pressure vulnerable senators.
Like Ron Johnson.
Like Ron Johnson. If Republicans don't pass a bill by Friday, June 30th, aka the end of next week, they will have to wait until July 10th, buying crucial time for opponents of the health care repeal.
Although I guess Ron Johnson isn't that vulnerable. He just won election. So
yeah, he doesn't have to think about his future for another, a little under 6 years, but yeah. That's still a long time.
The Senate health care bill will finally be pulled out of that smoke-filled room and released to the public on Thursday. That's what McConnell's saying.
That's tomorrow.
Yes. That will give lawmakers and the public only a few days to read it, digest its contents, receive analysis from the CBO about its costs and how many people will be covered. All, as Sam mentioned before, McConnell plans to bring it to the floor for a vote. Now, if they happen to be successful next week, this will, of course, be a wildly irresponsible abuse of power, fucking with the health insurance market with virtually no input from the public. But Republicans don't suffer political consequences for anything these days. Government shutdowns, debt limit chaos, Supreme Court obstruction. Now this. So far, they've been able to skate by on all this. One more evidence that the GOP operates with impunity. Look no further than just today, when Montana's Greg Gianforte was sworn into Congress a week after he pled guilty to assault charges for choke-slamming a reporter the night before his election, lying about it, and still winning the election. That's the show today. Listeners, call our rant line, leave a message. That number is 202-684-6108. Sponsors of the show include Chris Simpson and the Congressional Dish podcast, hosted by Jennifer Briney. Check it out at congressionaldish.com. Another sponsor, levelnews.org. Listen to this episode and all other episodes of our nightly newscast by going to districtsentinel.com. If you haven't yet, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or TuneIn by searching for District Sentinel Radio. Leave a review, give us a rating, tell your friends to listen. We're back tomorrow. We're in D.C., so you don't have to be.